Welcome to this podcast from the Medical Journal of Australia. My name is Sam Hunt, the MJA's news and online editor. Today we are discussing heart valve disease as part of Heart Valve Disease Awareness Week, which runs from the 26th of February to the 3rd of March. Calcified aortic stenosis is the third most frequent cardiovascular disease after coronary artery disease and hypertension in high-income countries. Up to 50% of people who develop severe aortic stenosis symptoms will not survive 2 years unless they have a valve replacement. The first presentation of aortic stenosis is often to the general practitioner, and as a result, GPs play a key role in the timely diagnosis and referral of patients with suspected aortic stenosis. Unfortunately, there is evidence that only 2/3 of patients with an established diagnosis of aortic stenosis actually receive treatment. This podcast is sponsored by Medtronic Australasia. The views and opinions expressed in the recording are those of the presenters and not necessarily representative of Medtronic Australasia Proprietary Limited. My special guests today are Dr. James Roy and Associate Professor Caleb Azris. They are structural and interventional cardiologists from Sydney and will be discussing screening, diagnosis and treatment options for aortic stenosis. Dr. Roy and Associate Professor Azris, thank you so much for joining me today.
Sam, thank you so much. It's a great opportunity.
Sam, fantastic. Thanks for having us.
Dr. Roy, let me go to you first. For general practitioners listening to this podcast, can you please give me an overview of the prevalence of aortic stenosis in Australia?
Sam, so this is an extremely common condition, particularly in patients in their 70s and 80s, and makes up one of the more common conditions, certainly one of the more common valvular heart conditions we see, particularly in this age group. Occasionally, we do see it in patients who are younger, in their 50s and 60s, if they have a congenital two-leaflet aortic valve. This condition can affect people a little younger, but it's predominantly a very common condition in older patients in their late 70s and 80s.
And Associate Professor Azris, this is a disease that is regularly missed. Why is this so? And how frequently are you seeing it being missed?
That's exactly right, Sam. Unfortunately, the majority of patients in the community are undiagnosed with moderate or severe symptomatic aortic stenosis. There's a lot of patients that will come, I'm sure, will come onto the symptoms, but we only see a very small fraction of the patients that are out there in the community. And sadly, a lot of the times that we see people, obviously working in the hospital, is that when it's quite late on in the process where patients have suffered with heart failure and or syncope or worse. So this is why we're quite keen to sort of raise awareness and get people to screen patients and actually think about the disease. And I think some of the problems that will come on again with the symptoms, they can be fairly indolent and a lot of people just pass it off, particularly in their 70s and 80s, as something else, old age or fitness and other things. So, but these are potentially warning signals that there may be something more sinister at play.
And Dr. Roy, we touched on symptoms there. I'll go to you to expand on that. What kind of symptoms should GPs be looking for in that first instance?
Look, I think the commonest symptom is by far shortness of breath and also fatigue. As the aortic valve narrowing progresses, syncope or collapse is a much more sinister symptom. Occasionally, people can get chest tightness or angina when they exert themselves. It is, as Caleb mentioned, that sometimes these symptoms, particularly fatigue and breathlessness, are attributed by patients to be just a symptom of aging. So it's very important to go back and actually ask questions like, are you able to walk the same distance you walked 12 months ago? Has that changed? And I think really trying to find out how their exercise tolerance has changed is an important part of that history.
And a lot of this comes down to patient awareness. Associate Professor Azris, the Awareness Week will help with awareness and making sure patients go to the GP in the first place.
Absolutely. There are opportunities for heart health checks, because patients do come in with other problems and may not necessarily volunteer some of these problems. So I think the first key thing is to suspect these problems from the GP, and the history being 90%, we've always taught of the sort of diagnosis. And then the rest in terms of investigations would be that we really want to examine the patient. Specifically, there are other things at the bedside, like a blood pressure, but a clinical examination where we use our stethoscope to have a listen is probably the key investigation for us. And in terms of that process, of course, we can go back to medical school and exams and so on, but actually it's very simple. If you hear a murmur that you don't think is normal, it doesn't matter where it's ejacistolic, pan-systolic, diastolic, then that should be the trigger to refer, at least sort of you're suspecting it, and refer for onward investigation to a cardiologist, specifically for an echocardiogram, which is a very sophisticated and accurate way to assess the patient further.
And Dr. Roy, it's that murmur that should trigger the referral to a specialist?
Absolutely. I think particularly a lot of GPs will be very used to clinically assessing these murmurs, but unfortunately, clinical assessment's not always accurate in determining the severity of this valvular problem. And we can all sometimes get that wrong. So it's useful to have a baseline measurement. They may only have mild or moderate aortic stenosis, but that will also be important in determining their follow-up and when they next need to be assessed. But obviously, when combined with a concerning history, I think that makes it all the more important to have that patient assessed with an echocardiogram.
And Associate Professor Azras, it's also vital that a multidisciplinary heart team is involved in any kind of treatment discussion.
Indeed, and thanks for mentioning the heart team. And it's been a wonderful experience to be part of this process. And it's been one of the great things coming out of the evolution and revolution of structural heart interventions, because procedures and assessment of patients, it's mandated that patients should go through a heart team process, which involves a range of interventional cardiologists that perform the procedures, general cardiologists that would not be performing procedures, cardiothoracic surgeons that would be involved either with the transcatheter procedures or obviously with the open heart surgery procedures. We also have aged care physicians that assess frailty and capacity of our patients in terms of, as well as cognitive assessments. So for us, that's the key, and that's with most heart teams. But we also have additional specialists, whether it's respiratory, renal, neurosurgical, whatever it might be, gastroenterology, that would feed into that discussion. So any members of that team that the patient is referred to have an opportunity to have to be assessed and be offered all treatment options. And ultimately, the consensus and decision-making and what's offered to the patient is based on the discussions of that team as opposed to an individual's decision.
And Dr. Roy, let me ask you about patient perspectives. A patient, when they see you, may be concerned they may have to have quite invasive surgery. Are you finding you're having to improve patient knowledge about their possible treatment options?
Look, obviously, that's a very important part of the discussion, what the natural time course of this condition is, and working out for a certain patient, is intervention warranted at all, or is their aortic stenosis not bad enough to need treatment? You need to weigh that against the risks of any potential surgery. So we have that discussion, obviously, in depth with the patient. And unfortunately, there's not really any non-invasive successful treatments for this condition. So there's no medication that's been proven to improve this condition. There's no diet or exercise program. This is simply wear and tear of the aortic valve. So frustratingly, we haven't yet got a sort of medical cure for this, as it's a mechanical problem. So we hope that one day that will evolve, but fortunately now we have less invasive options to treat patients with this condition.
Associate Professor Azras, there is an aged care physician or geriatrician in the heart team. What kind of specialist advice are they giving, since so many people with this condition are in their 70s or 80s?
I think this is the key member of our heart team. In a younger population, and we are moving into a lower risk population of treatment, then decisions and discussions are more straightforward, usually towards either surgery or a transcatheter approach. When patients are older, more comorbid and frail, the decision and discussion is actually much more nuanced and does require expertise in terms of their frailty, cognition. We do have various standardized scoring systems for these things, but also actually seeing the patient that often have multiple issues that they need to be that need to be looked at, I think is a key thing. Having said that, we may go into data and so on, but if we look at the very first cohort of patients that went through the process, essentially this is the inoperable patients that were too frail to have surgery, so they were offered medical therapy or a transcatheter approach in the form of a transcatheter aortic valve implantation. And at 1 year following, they're randomized, there was a 40% absolute risk in mortality difference in these patients between optimal medical therapy and transcatheter aortic valve implantation. So it's one of the biggest impacts to sort of healthcare that we've seen in the last 20 odd years. So you'd be surprised that there is a huge benefit to a lot of these patients. Having said that, having the expertise in a heart team to recognize the patients that would benefit and perhaps those that should be treated medically or conservatively or supportively is a key part of our decision-making as we're moving and treating patients in the 80s and even beyond. So I can't stress enough the importance of an aged care physician.
And Dr. Roy, let's unpack the differences between a TAVI procedure and surgery. What risks and benefits are you and your colleagues weighing up?
First and foremost, obviously, having any procedure, we want to minimize risks of any procedure. A lot of patients are obviously also focused on the recovery and the recovery time. Obviously, time is precious for everyone, and you don't want to spend months and months recovering from a procedure if possible. One of the biggest benefits, obviously, from a patient's perspective is the much quicker recovery from a TAVI transcatheter valve rather than having their chest open with surgery. Most patients, when given the choice, will obviously opt for the less invasive approach. Fortunately, we now have very good data suggesting that on many important fronts like mortality and reduction in stroke risk, TAVI is preferable and has a lower risk of both of those things. There is a slight trade-off. The rate of pacemaker can be slightly higher for TAVI patients, but I think on balance, if you could take a lower rate of mortality and stroke, the risk of pacemaker, most people will still opt for that less invasive approach. So it's been a huge advance, particularly in that recovery.
And Associate Professor Azras, let's dig a bit deeper into trends in the population, which you mentioned before. There's, of course, the aging population and aortic stenosis still going undetected.
Absolutely. I mean, we're all aware and keep us all busy. The population is aging, and just give you an idea in terms of numbers, you know, 65-year-old, there's probably sort of 3-4% risk that they may have severe symptomatic aortic stenosis. Go up to 80%, we're talking over 10% of our patient population. So if you can imagine how many 80-year-olds that we're going to see, you know, 1 in 10 will have severe symptomatic aortic stenosis. Most of them are going undiagnosed. So that trend in patients is obviously extending. The burden of the disease is significant. So, you know, in terms of numbers, we're talking approximately 100,000 patients in Australia have severe symptomatic aortic stenosis. It paints a good picture, but we perform around 6,000 procedures, transcatheter procedures a year across the country. And it's probably about 50-50 versus surgery versus a transcatheter approach. So there's about 6,000 procedures having surgery. So we're talking just a small proportion, just a tiny, maybe 10% of our patients are getting treatment year on year. So you can see the big burden is actually in the community of undiagnosed patients. That's where I think there's great opportunity for primary care to help us help in the fight.
And Dr. Roy, when you're seeing a patient, I understand it can be hard to get a comprehensive medical history, and aortic stenosis can be progressing in the background without anybody's knowledge.
Because of the issues we discuss in terms of getting a good history, does mean that there's still patients that are not necessarily picked up with this condition. I'm still amazed. We're still seeing patients present to hospital, sometimes with quite extreme heart failure symptoms, that haven't ever had this condition picked up. The other thing is that sometimes it can progress quite quickly. So patients can go from having mild aortic stenosis and really progress quite rapidly over a period, for example, of 12 months. So I think there's no doubt, as Caleb said, that there's a lot of patients that unfortunately just don't have this condition picked up. And we're trying to, I suppose, raise awareness rather than patients presenting to hospital very unwell, that it's picked up in the early stages in the primary care setting and referred appropriately.
And Associate Professor Azras, what are the key take-home messages for GPs?
Thank you for the opportunity to discuss this. And I think the key take-home messages are that we should suspect that these patients are out in the community, and the primary care is the biggest opportunity to diagnose patients, and hopefully early on in the path, and they could be followed up appropriately. I think when we suspect it, I think we should be listening to patients, so with the stethoscope as well as obviously the history. So listening to the patient's hearts and trying to detect a murmur, because it's very obvious when it's there. And also think about, to suspect in a slightly younger population, anyone above 65, we should be thinking about an annual heart check their options to bring patients back to diagnose them. And if there is any suspicion in terms of a murmur, the easiest thing is to refer them to a heart team for further investigation and management.
And Dr. Roy, just to end on a lighter note, if this condition is picked up sooner and treated sooner across the population, you both may be out of a job.
I think we're still a while off that yet, Sam, in terms of, as I mentioned, medical management. I'm hoping sometime in the future we see some new treatments come along to try and help prevent this condition. For the moment, we're fortunate to have this new technology coming through. And I think, you know, in 10 or 15 years' time, we'll be talking about even better developments in this amazing technology.
Dr. James Roy and Associate Professor Caleb Azras, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks again, Sam.
Thanks, Sam.
My special guests have been Dr. James Roy and Associate Professor Caleb Azras, who are structural and interventional cardiologists from Sydney, and we've been discussing screening, diagnosis, and treatment options for aortic stenosis. This podcast is sponsored by Medtronic Australasia. The views and opinions expressed in the recording are those of the presenters and not necessarily representative of Medtronic Australasia. You can find more podcasts from the Medical Journal of Australia on our website at mja.com.au or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.